Sareed.
Hello. Yo.
Yo, how you doing, man?
Mosk is good, man. Good to hear you.
Yeah, good to hear you too. I'm yeah, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
it's probably
from
been...
another dimension.
Yeah. At least a couple decades. Well, no, I don't know when the last time. I think I saw you in. You came up briefly while you were still in New York, and I saw you at a gig.
Whatever it is, it's been at least 10 years.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that was 12, 13 years ago.
That's fucking wild, man. I'm in the I'm in the CKUT production studio. There's no pressure on us right now, so.
Nice.
I'm going to ask you a couple different questions. I was thinking I'd split it up into kind of two parts, because one, I wanted to ask you about your memories of CKUT, because we're still doing the 30th anniversary project, even though the 30th was like 2 years ago. Louise and I are still, you know, trying to collect memories and memorabilia and whatnot. And then I'm going to ask you about what's going on now about your artistic life. I'm so curious.
Yeah. Life is strange.
Yeah, right.
Life is strange, man. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, not exactly how I thought, you know, it would be. But
no,
that's a part of the fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's almost like whatever happened to me in Montreal at CKUT kind of became this formula embedded in my DNA, and it's all I can fucking do anymore.
Right.
DIY music shit.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, same here. Sometimes I try and get out, and I think this is too insane. I gotta stop it, but you know, all it takes is a week, and then I'm back in it.
Something draws you back in.
I wish you could see the city, because it's completely not as you remember it. But if you walk through, it's insane. But if you walked into into CKUT, nothing has changed. It's like this.
That's amazing.
It's this kind of like the land that time forgot, you know, because the city of Montreal has completely been. I mean, it would blow your mind to see it. I mean, some things are the same, but fuck, man, it's crazy how much it's changed. I'm living out in Hochelaga, Maisonneuve. I remember you lived out there with Adu.
Yeah. Is it all condos now?
No, but it's coming. It's starting. That process has started. St. Henry, where you also lived, and I lived for 15 years, is all condos now.
That's mad.
And
I try to keep up. I try to keep up online, but it's just mad.
Yeah,
so much change. But it's lovely that, like, I always thought CKUT will always be its own time capsule. You know, like,
yeah.
There's no time capsule. Like, it's still in the same building.
Yep.
So there's nothing like.
It's everything's the same. The music offices, all the offices are the same. Louise is still there. You know, the staff is different. But the people running the shows, you know, a lot of the cats, you know, are still the same. That's crazy too, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's amazing for the longevity of the spirit of what CKT has always been about.
Yeah, I want to ask you, like, just if you can. You know, any kind of memories that you have from your time as a volunteer or on staff, anything that sticks out as like really valuable memories, or memories that stayed with you, or that, you know, kept you going later on in life, or whatever it is.
Yeah, man, I got a few. I mean, always, honestly, over time, the most intense memory that I always equate with CKUT, like the first thing that pops up whenever I remember, you know, my times there, was really like my first, like at that time, all new volunteers had to go through this kind of training where it involved like a bit of training in each individual department. So you got some training in the on-air booth, then in the production studio, then in the music library, and then like one and one, so on. So my first day volunteer training, the first person I'm put up with is Prime Time. And Prime Time, I mean, is a legend already. And I mean, I'm strolling up to, you know, to meet him for the first time, and everyone's already telling like epic legendary myths of, you know, his accomplishments, and, you know, well, he is. And I had no idea what he was in for. Basically, I was, it was like an hour of just being blown away by this man in the booth, and just like, I had no idea what I was in for, you know. And I still remember, like, we get into the on-air booth, and he's like, all right, well, you know, you just sit back and watch. You know, it's your first day. I was like, cool, I'm cool with that. I don't know what any of this stuff is, what any of this stuff does. All I know is I'm in for some good reggae music. And back then, like, I mean, CKT was my whole introduction to, like, a whole universe of music that, you know, I wasn't so well acquainted with. And, like, I was looking forward to it. And in front of my eyes, Prime Time transformed into this, like, octopus who was simultaneously, you know, loading up the cartridge decks and pulling up a 45, flipping another 45, pulling the mic close to him, getting on the mic, and it was live. It was just lit with, you know, just him in the studio. And but then just like 2-3 minutes into the show is when the real magic happened. The door just flung open, and there was like a constant stream of like visitors, his friends, and he's just shouting them out one after the other. Hey, so-and-so's in, and so-and-so. And I guess that was where I really understood, like, okay, wow, this is what community radio is, you know? The whole community was up in there in the studio at 3 p.m. on a, I think he had his shows on Thursday. On what, the Tuesday, the Wednesday? Thursday, yeah.
Thursday 3, Positive Vibes.
Man.
And it's still,
yeah, Positive Vibes.
It's still on the air, and it's still it still gets mad busy in the studio when that show happens.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, I didn't know what I was in for, you know? I mean, like, for all intents and purposes, I was coming from the equivalent of a small town, you know, from abroad, you know? And I had no idea what I was in for. And, yeah, that's a moment that I always cherish. It was just like, all right, we're in for a ride now, you know?
Yeah.
And then I remember another memory, like, right after that. I can't remember. I think it must have been that I was talking with John B, but my memory is hazy. It was, you know, with one of the staffers. Just, he was generally introducing me to, you know, the station and the programming at the station. And, you know, I was just looking at it. I was like, hey, what's that show? Oh, that's the Korean community show. Oh, you don't say. Hey, what's this one? It's that's the experimental goth techno show that like this guy's been doing for 20 years. Oh, you don't say. It was just like wowzers.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a ride. Coming from a place where you make a new friend and they're like, so what are your 5 favorite bands? Meaning assuming that like there's just 5 to choose from, right, as opposed to 5 gazillion. You and your homies were pretty pivotal in introducing me to a shit ton of music, like to Darren Peacock, Graham Thomas, Bartek, yeah. The whole Ottawa squad. They literally just made me sit down and yeah, say like, "You haven't heard this? I can't believe you've never heard this." And then they played this. And then it went on to, what, you've never heard that? I can't believe you've never heard that. Put on that, you know, that, you know. And, it was amazing.
Yeah, the whole... Maybe you could tell the people just a bit about yourself. And, I mean, I realize that there's, like, we provided no context from where you were coming from, what the situation was. Why don't you talk a bit about... you know, when you showed up at CQT, who you were, where you came from, what was going on?
Yeah. Well, I'm from India, and I grew up in different parts of Asia. and I arrived in Montreal in the fall of 1998 to attend McGill University. And pretty much right during Frost Week, I landed up at CKUT. So that was 1998. I was looking forward to getting in there. You know, right when I landed, it was a priority, and yeah, it exceeded my expectations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that was that.
I want to stress that it wasn't just, you became so involved in the city. You landed, you almost immediately organizing events, playing in a number of different musical formations, obviously at CKUT. Still on the wall, we have in the music office, we have two posters for the Explosions Underground Music Festival. People still talk about those gigs. That festival was incredible. And when I look at the lineup and how amazingly curated that festival was, some of those people went on to amazing things on top of what they were already doing, amazing things. And I saw a great photo recently of Mr. Microwave playing at that festival. It's Mr. Microwave with a microwave on his head and a very young group of people, all of which, went on to do amazing things in the city. But that festival was also one of the first kind of official things that happened at Casa del Popolo as well.
It was.
Maybe you could talk about just, what it was like for you. I know it's so long ago, but just being involved in the city.
Yeah, I will. And when I landed up in Montreal, as I'm sure for a lot of youngsters showing up for their first stab at university, it was like letting the genie out the bottle, It was like, wow, there's this whole city here, there's all these people here who are doing interesting things, and you can be a part of it. You can be a part of this huge scene. It's not just you and your high school friends anymore. So I dove right in, and everyone was so helpful and supportive, like you, and you helped me with a bunch of those, but you put me in touch with Mr. Microwave, if I remember correctly. I guess there was also this kind of youthful naivete about me at that time, where I was just, let's do this. I want to do stuff. I want to do crazy stuff. I want to do wild stuff. And, I don't know what it's like now, but back then, definitely at most of the punk rock clubs, you could just walk in and ask to speak with the owner and just set up, there was nothing too big about just booking a show, and I thought that was incredible,
Yeah. I remember it wasn't just bars either. Sorry to interrupt, but I remember you doing them in your apartment too, down on St. Antoine Street.
Yeah, why not? if you can get away with it, I can't do that anymore where I live. But there was, like I said, a certain youthful naivete about it. Back when I was in high school, where I grew up as a teenager in the UAE, there weren't really clubs or anywhere for us to play, for bands or musicians to play. So, I used to have, shows at my place back then too, up on the roof, in this apartment building. So that was maybe just a continuation, but, I don't know.
The music has to happen somewhere anymore.
Was that?
The music has to happen somewhere. People find a way.
Yeah, exactly. The music finds a way. And I don't know exactly what it's like anymore in the West. I haven't been back in 10 years, but in general, from what I see online and in other cities and other parts of the world, everything's become I feel like there's I'm almost 40 now, so I get to go say these things like, kids these days. Kids these days. But it feels like kids are trying to get managers and tunes signed before even just doing a little house party and having 15, 20 friends over and just raging, you know?
Yeah.
But for me, that's what it was all about. 15, 20 becomes 80 or 100, and then the next thing you know, you like some of our friends from that scene, just next thing you know, you're on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the city of Montreal still manages to support that kind of DIY scene, but it's increasingly difficult to find space, to find... I mean, a big problem, especially in the neighborhoods that you probably remember nightlife in Montreal being in, the Plateau, Mile End, the big problem is just noise complaints. You know, venues can't, they're at war with the neighbors. You know, venues are at war with the neighbors. And more and more, it's just being pushed out to, you know, places like Hochelaga where... you can still get away with some industrial space or way up in Park Extension, you know, but the core of the city is becoming, you know, devoid of any kind of that spirit that we remember. But it still exists. It still exists, which is the important thing. You just got to travel a little bit further.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about some of the groups you were involved with because they're all amazing. I mean, there was Detroit Metal. We'll start with that. I mean, you were instrumental in that group. I mean, I know it was yourself, Darren. I mean, it was expanding and contracting. That was almost like a collective. Melanie, whose last name I can't remember. Will Glass was in that band. Ed Orloff was in that band. I mean, these are all great musicians. Maybe you talk just a bit about Detroit Metal.
Yeah, I think that was the first thing, first like band outfit I started, and I guess it was a collective, and I was king of the collective. So, but yeah, that was fun, you know, and Montreal was my introduction also to improvised music and all different kinds of experimentation, and you know, I dove right in, and I guess Detroit Metal, I tried to put together, and Dove Winkleman, we almost forgot. I almost tried to piece together, you know, the weirdest people I could find from the shows that I was going to, and, you know, and who were just up for jamming and seeing what could happen. And playing shows with Detroit Metal led me to meeting Chloe Lum.
Yeah.
Chloe saw me first playing with Detroit Metal, and she came to me, and well, first she asked me to go for dinner, and I was like, cool. I was, you know, quite flattered, and we went to this Indian place, which is cool, because I'm Indian, but it was lovely, and then she asked me, she's like, yeah, I'm starting this band, do you want to be in it? I was like, well, of course, and then she took me right away to meet Yannick, there on low, and then that was that, and that was the beginning of the Bloody Gashes.
Yeah, the legendary Bloody Gashes.
I had a lot of fun with that crew.
Yeah, that record is still, you know, it's still a high watermark for a lot of crazy things. There's a record that maybe didn't get made or didn't get released that was recorded.
Yeah.
There was with Tim Glasgow, who went on to be in-house tech for Sonic Youth. I remember you guys went and recorded with him in London, Ontario.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was telling Louise, I remember you guys were on the cover of the Montreal Mirror, and it came out, I think, 2 days after 9/11.
Yeah, I think
and you were
maybe a
covered in blood,
infamous thing,
covered in fake blood.
Yeah,
and and I remember it was sort of a controversial thing. I mean, I don't think they had a choice. They probably sent the thing to the printer, you know, before they knew that.
Yeah,
before anyone
yeah.
knew that
yeah.
was going on. But
We had some explaining to do.
Yeah.
I said, blame Rupert Buttenberg. Blame Rupert Buttenberg. He's the editor.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, man, those were next big thing days,
yeah.
You know? And, but I guess, the group of people we were, we, like, everything had to be the next big thing. So you're always trying to be on the next thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, that I still have all that music. I still have the unreleased EP, and every now and then over here in India, where I'm living now, every now and then I pull it out because I have a whole new, you know, group of like friends and acquaintances and work colleagues here who have no idea of my murky, notorious past in Montreal, and every now and then I pull out pictures of the bloody guys to show them and play them the music, and yeah, it's like it's like a missive from another dimension.
Yeah. Well, it was wild because that band was, you know, it was always a crazy band, but it was, for all intents and purposes, it was a garage rock band or a punk rock band. But towards the end, it got really crazy. It got really, I don't know, you know, how much of it was improvised and how much it was planned, but it became completely abstract and almost like a noise band.
Yeah. Well, we like Sonic Youth and Royal Trucks and all that stuff. So that's kind of what we wanted to do, and have a hype stage show, you know?
Yeah.
So...
they definitely had
as wild as they want to be.
Yeah. The next project I remember you doing with Dane Mills was Alm Supreme.
Yeah.
First time I saw someone roll up into Kaza with a desktop computer and make music with it.
Yeah.
Dane went on. Yeah. Dane was the first drummer in the Arcade Fire, who of course we all know. And maybe talk a bit about Alm Supreme. I have that CD somewhere.
Yeah. Yo, so so Dane came over to visit me recently because he was living in Taiwan and I'm out here in India, and I think that was 2-3 years ago. And yeah, it was a riot catching up. Dane was the original drummer for Arcade Fire, and I think you know, we were like at that time, right? Like you know, the early 2000s. A lot of us rockers were, you know, it feels like we're at that, at least for us. It felt like a lot of rockers were getting exposed to electronic music, dance music, disco music, and, you know, with laptops becoming more and more common, you know, you're thinking of like, hey, I can make music on this thing. How do I make music on this laptop? And, you know, so that's kind of what drew Dane and me together, was just, we, you know, we used to use these obscure programs, these trackers, and it was really painstaking to make anything with it. Mm. But we did, and we didn't MIDI sync our systems together either. It was all manual. It was like a resurrection of Devo. Right, with synths, like we were the robots, and yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. I guess we brought our like a punk rock attitude to making it and doing the shows, and there were already like a lot of quite a few like house and techno purists who came across what we did and would just straight up tell us, like, you're doing it wrong. You have no idea what you're doing, do you? You're doing it wrong. And we didn't care. We were just having too much fun.
Yeah.
It was that weird middle time when punk rockers set up laptops in the middle of dance floors, you know?
Yeah.
With a table in the middle of the dance floor. Got Girl Talk, Dan Deacon, you know?
Yeah.
So we wanted to be part of that.
I remember seeing you after you had just come out of a concert at one of the festivals here, and I remember it was Farmer's Almanac, which I'd never heard of before. But your eyes were kind of pointing in two different directions, and you were just like, Moskis, my brain just got fried. I've never seen anything like this before in my life, you know. I don't know if you remember that concert, but I remember your being just seeing you being so. You'd just been at this thing that obviously had really affected you.
That honestly sounds like about every weekend that I went out to like some, you know, kind of show. I mean, you probably didn't notice, but that's exactly the look I had right after the first time I saw Kubelka when you guys got together again for a reunion. The first time I saw Ficus, good God, oh man, I remember all kinds of weird shows I went to. I still have those posters with me. They're actually still right here on my desk. I keep meaning to put them up. Yeah. Posters of shows at Hotel Tango and all these places.
Yeah.
So, Casa Sala Rosa.
When you... back to Om Supreme for a moment, just, you know, learning obscure music software... did you have any idea, were you immediately attracted to it? Did you have any idea that maybe that kind of electronic music might be something that you would go into? Because, I mean, it seems like that's the style you're rocking now, you know?
I'll tell you what it was, man. Like, I mean, quite honestly, in both bands, both those main, like, bands that I've been in, like Buddy Gash's, after all this work and time together, fine, we just grew apart as people and the band broke up. But, you know, it also been, spent a lot of time, you know, we went through like five drummers, you know.
Yeah.
And after all that kind of stuff, I was at this point where I was like, I think even Dane was at this point where I just wanted to be independent. Like, here's a system now that, like, forget about lugging like guitars and effects pedals and helping to load up the drum kit, you know, later while maybe, you know, the drummer's away getting drunk. I don't know. But it was just like, you can take control of it all, right? You know, I don't need to know how to play the drums. I can plug it all in, you know, to the sequencer and boom, it's there. Yeah. And it sounds hard, you know?
Yeah.
So, I think it was that, like, that independence that, like, really drew me to making music on laptops. And yeah, I mean, still to this day right now, I'm like 90% of it is in the box, you know. And usually when I try to go out of the box and record something live, you know, now like or acoustic, like it just never ends up in a place that I need it to be. So, but. Yeah, and like it's, I never, you know, I mean, I never intended to be a music producer, right? Like all this time in Montreal, all that stuff was still for fun and like pocket change, you know? But like now it's evolved to the point that, I guess, I mean, even though it's not like a direct relation, but like, yeah, that's like, what I do now, man. I'm a DJ / producer.
Yeah. Well, I gotta say, I'm not
kit for it. Yeah, there's a whole kit for it.
Yeah, I'm not. It's no surprise, though. You know, to me, anyway.
What's that?
I mean, finding out that this is what you do now is not a surprise for me, and I'm sure anyone else that knew you back in the
day. It's a surprise for me. It's a surprise for me, because so I left Montreal as I came back to India for a year. I was working at a consulting company, and then I went back to and I went to New York for my master's degree. I did an MBA, and then I was working in New York for a couple of years. Well, like 3 years as a music publicist at this company called World's Fair. And I grew so sick of what the music industry was becoming at that time. At that time, 2005 to 2008 was when independent music was just exploding online. You had Pitchfork was becoming more important than MTV. YouTube was exploding. And there were blogs and there were websites and along with this, you know, increase in media, there was an explosion of bands and musical artists and performers all vying to get attention. And it felt amazing being in the center of it in New York, but in a way I kind of like burned out and I just had enough of it, and my whole plan, I mean, also at a personal level at that time, like, my mom passed away, and she was really special to me, and so I was kind of stuck in New York, like, just not really feeling any of this anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I thought, let me move back to the motherland, where India, where there is no independent music scene, there's just Bollywood and traditional folk music, you know. I thought I would move back here and work with some NGOs and try to do some good, and maybe try to pursue writing, like write an epic sci-fi, the epic Indian sci-fi novel of his generation.
You can still do that, by the way.
What's that?
You can still do that, by the way. It's never too late to write an epic sci-fi novel. Just saying.
Well, it's never too late to start writing that thing. Yeah, but I don't know. But yeah, anyways, like we were saying, like, you know, the universe has a funny way of self-correcting, and, you know, turned out that right when I was moving back here in 2008, moving back to New Delhi, city of my birth, in 2009 is just when the independent scene in India just started kicking off,
yeah.
You know, and those embers have kind of become infernos now, like, whew.
It's like I was saying at the beginning of our chat, you can't, if you're, you can't escape it. You try to get out, you end up right back in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, totally. So I wanted to talk about Surreal and about, you know, your career over there as a DJ and producer. Maybe just where did that start? Or you moved back to New Delhi. There was the beginnings of an independent music scene there. When did you say, okay, I'm gonna, you know, pull out the gear and start making records again, or start DJing again, or what?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, when I moved back here, for a long time there just wasn't really this kind of DIY ethic that a lot of us are accustomed to from the West, you know. And around that time is, I think, you know, there was the credit crunch, right? Like, worldwide.
Yeah.
And what that meant was a lot of people lost their jobs, so they lost their work visas, and they had to move back to India. A lot of people who were pursuing master's and PhD degrees, maybe their grants got canceled, and they had to move back. So at least in Delhi at that time, it was like the atmosphere was ripe for a cultural renaissance. These people who'd been exposed to a world outside of India suddenly moved back and were in the same place. And that just added, you know, fuel to the creatives who are already here, who were just accustomed to remaining hidden because they're, you know, like, there was no, like, outgoing nightlife culture here. There were no gig venues. There were, like, you know, whatever art galleries there were. I mean, it was like a cultural void when we talk about, like, art that is not sponsored by the government or some corporation.
Right.
And, yes, it just so happened there are people with nothing to do or time in their hands are starting anew. And so people started putting on, you know, shows with whatever music they were into. There was a reggae crew, there was a German bass crew, a dubstep was big at that time, so there's a dubstep crew, and I think similar things started happening in the other big, like, you know, metropolises in India, Mumbai, and Bangalore. And yeah, like, for me, you know, it was at first just like, oh, okay, like, I'll, you know, DJ a set for fun. And but then, like, a friend of mine had started as like a cafe / pub / venue, and a small place, only really fit like, you know, 200, 300 people max if we squeezed them in. But you kind of started it just for fun. And I mean, just for fun, that's a weird thing to say, but like, he didn't have any grand intentions, you know. It was just something to, so, like, it was a job, you know. He thought he would be just serving sandwiches and coffee, you know. But very quickly, bands and DJs started lining up, just asking for if they could do shows there, because there was nowhere else in town where they could do that, you know, like I was saying about how special it is in a city like Montreal. You can just walk up to, you know, some of these places and ask for shows. So he started doing these shows, and very lo-fi level, and eventually reached, I mean, there were every night was packed with people because there was not much else to do, and it was a novelty. And pretty soon he ended up making silly mistakes like double booking bands and you know, not getting the right equipment. And that's when I stepped in and said, you know, hey, we're friends. This is like what I do. It's in my DNA. Why don't you let me take care of this? And that was the beginning of a quite beautiful 4-year, you know, relationship of running this place. And yeah, man, that neighborhood where we started this thing, TLR, the neighborhood is called the Hoskos Village. We were the first like club there. And if you go now, you know, within 3 years, it was completely gentrified. It went from one club to 5 clubs to 15 to like now there's like 100, 120 different establishments. You know, it's like a little, you know, it's like a little party ghetto. So, yeah, that was a wild ride. But pretty much somewhere along that road, I don't know, I think I've been yapping for a while, but somewhere along that road, eventually TLR had to shut for licensing issues. And but by then, like, I'd been DJing all the Saturday nights and I had a bit of a following, so I got myself some management and you know, never looked back.
The rest is history.
The rest is history.
I was reading the piece you wrote for Red Bull on DeciBass, and I which was great, and I just wanted to ask about that sound and that movement and where you fit into all of that.
So yeah, like at the time that you know, like I guess about 5, 7, 8 years ago, when trap music, like the EDM side of trap, and Mumbaton, and all these kinds of nano genres, or you know, new genres, started taking over the dance and pop music landscape. I guess in India, most electronic musicians, like, there's always been a culture of fusion, of East-West fusion.
Yeah.
You saw it with the Asian underground stuff in the 90s out of the UK.
Yeah.
You know, Asian Dub Foundation and whatnot.
Sure, yeah.
And even before that, if you, you know, think of some of the Bollywood greats, like there's composer producers like R.D. Berman, you know, who he was the first guy to use a Moog in Bollywood, you know.
Yeah.
And that was in the 70s, and yeah, there's always been this tradition of fusing Western stuff that helps make it more palatable here to like a wider audience, you know. So I guess some producers, including myself, started doing that for the new sound of dance music, you know, that the Diplos and the Skrillexes and all are pushing. And, you know, global bass being a thing, I like to think it was me. I slapped the Desi on it, and that's the Desi bass.
Yeah.
That's what we're calling. That's calling it. That's my story. We're sticking to it. So... Cool. Yeah, so now that sound is like, you know, it's taken over. One of the biggest DJs here in India right now, his name is Nuclear. And I was here at a time, like, you know, I got to see that growth of him playing his sound, this new Desi bass sound, to 10 people, 100 people, 1,000. And now it's like 10,000 at a time. Like, you can't get it, Dickie. Scalping tickets for his stadium shows, you know.
Damn. It seems like you play in front of some really big audiences. Do you find that it's difficult to push boundaries or to be rebellious when you got to face down a crowd of, I mean, I know you're older now, so it's like those kind of things are not so important, but when you're facing down a crowd of however many hundreds or, you know, 1,000 people or however many people you play in front of, it's more than, you know, 15, 20 friends or even just, you know, 40 people. at the CASA.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been blessed. I've had a lot of opportunity to go and figure things out in that arena. And I think it really depends. You know, like with any kind of DJ, you have to understand your crowd and the environment and the context of what's going on.
Yeah.
So there are some festivals that I'm booked at with thousands of people where I know that, okay, this is a very commercial crowd. Yeah. It's more, you know, normals, but everybody's just here to have fun.
Right.
So I would play, you know, a more simple, direct set for them.
Yeah.
But then there are festivals that I get booked at with large crowds where, okay, I know these guys are down. Like, they know what's hype. They want to hear the new stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's, you know, and to me, that's still part of the attraction of this whole scheme of DJing and producing for the Desi dance floors, as I like to call them. It's of understanding your audience and, you know, trying to keep them happy and at the same time introduce them to new stuff and, you know, just kind of carry them forward a bit. It's a little different, difficult to describe because so much of it here, it's like there's social change happening at a mass level, you know?
Right.
Like when I go play at a college festival, you know, like maybe 10%, 20% of those kids grew up in urban areas and are relatively hip. But still, that 80% mass are coming from small towns, rural areas, villages. It might be in school or on scholarship, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This might literally be, for some of them, their first encounter with this kind of big show Western culture, you know.
Right.
And for all the and for everything that it stands for, you know. And, you know, I think of it as a, we have a bit of a responsibility to, like, to do it right. You know. Yeah.
I wanted to ask about the new record. It's called Visa on Arrival. Is that that's out on all the platforms, I imagine?
Yeah.
Why don't you just talk about the new record? And I'm also just curious about your process, where you make your music, where you get your inspiration from. What was making Visa on Arrival like?
Yeah, so my two albums before this were Trapistan.
Yep.
Trapistan and Twerkistan were both done along those lines of Desi bass, East-West fusion, and trying to contextualize these new sounds for an Indian audience. And for the last 2-3 years, what I've seen really growing over here and what started, you know, inspiring me more, I've been the dance hall and reggaeton scenes. Reggaeton especially, like, people don't understand, but like the current language of Bollywood and Hindi pop music is reggaeton.
Right.
Like everything is on a dembow rhythm. And to me, that's like fascinating, you know? And similarly, like dance hall, the vocals, you know, are in the dance hall style. And so, plus I have a lot of friends here that, like, in the general scheme of underground dance music, you know, who kicked things off here in Delhi, crews like Reggae Rajas, Bass Foundation, they were all about introducing reggae and dub based music to Indian listeners, you know.
Right.
And I mean, sure, we have Apache Indian, who's still active and a legend, a living legend, but you know, there's a whole universe beyond that. And we've seen like modern dance music is like directly derived from, you know, dub culture, right? Like,
yeah.
Prince Jammy and all that stuff. Yeah, so this album.
For sure.
So, but yeah, so reggaeton and dancehall really blooming. And also, what's really inspired me here, so, I mean, reggaeton and dancehall I'm talking about because, you know, they formed the basis for the new album, Visa on Arrival. They're the main, like, genre influences. And what's another thing that like really inspired me in the last couple of years is we've seen a huge growth in the scene of dance hall dancers in India. Mm-hmm. You know, dancing the Jamaican dancers, and they've been flying in Jamaican dancers like the OGs and the stars, and you know, legit people to give classes. And I've seen the classes go from being like a few dozen people to like hundreds, you know, like you know, there's always been an amazing like youth dance culture in India that's largely been around Bollywood dancing on the one side and hip-hop dancing. You know, if you turn on the TV here, you know, there's many, many like dance shows with just teams of kids like dancing, you know, and every city has dance crews, kids, they compete, you know, like that scene is very rife. But I've always felt a lot of it, especially, you know, on the hip-hop side of things, Western music side of things, hip-hop, breakdancing, b-boying, completely dominated by the lads, you know, of course, by the boys. But when it comes to dancehall, it's all the girls, you know, and there are these, you know, the moves are quite sexual. Some in conservative Indian society might say vulgar and inappropriate for a woman, you know. And so to me, I think it's a very important like social movement that's happening, you know, that in the light of all the other societal problems we have here, it's, you know, let these girls get some, you know. So that's really been inspiring to me.
Cool. I wanted to just circle back and ask about when you make a record. I mean, clearly these days all you need is a computer to make a record. You don't need. Do you sit down in the study in your apartment and do you do it in the morning? Do you do it in the afternoon? When do you create? I'm curious.
Well, all the tracks on my album, like, I mean, I'm really slow at finishing tracks.
Me too.
You know, whenever I get a chance to work on it, I do. I guess most of the tracks on the album, most of the stuff I make in general, I mean, most of the stuff on the album took like a couple of years, right? Because what happened was just over 2 years back, I started working on some of the tracks on the album, but then I got selected to be a contestant on this TV show on Amazon Prime.
Make some noise, guys, and welcome to the remix!
I wanted to ask you about that too, so it's a good...
So that show's called The Remix, and it's this pretty intense competition. So I guess it's this competition where there are teams. Each team has one music producer, one singer, and each episode we have to remix a Bollywood track in a modern style.
Yeah.
And there's judges, and you know, there's eliminations, and each episode, the tasks get tougher and tougher. Like some episodes, eventually you're remixing, you know, two tracks for each episode, and then different kinds of themes. And basically, I ended up winning that contest. But it took like 3-4 months of shooting, and then when it finally aired or went online on Amazon Prime Video, that was a while. So I put off like working on the album, and then I got back to it. And then when I got back to it, though, I'd learned a lot of things from my experience on the show, because that show, whereas I've generally been outside of the Bollywood system, this being such a corporate branded project was very much inside the Bollywood system. And, you know, we had really tight deadlines. So what they do is each team, like Bollywood production, the way they need it, it's pretty like full on, you know, like everything has 10 layers on top of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's just the way they insist on doing things. So it was a lot of work for like one person to do, and like basically had like 24 to 36 hours to do the remix. So you'd get assistant producers, Now, those assistant producers they gave us are the guys who work in, I mean, they're basically these Bollywood music factories. Like, these days, the main, like, Bollywood music producers, they're like brands, like Preetam, Abhijit Vagani, they're brands. But they have a whole, like, factory of kids, you know, actually doing the work. You know,
right.
One guy sitting in studio recording the singer, another guy's like making the top line, and then another guy is changing the beat to, like, you know, it was like factory. Yep. So getting to work with these guys and seeing, like, okay, wow, this is, can you guys do it? So each track on my album, when I went back to work on it, I really enjoyed this process of just remixing the remix of the remix of the remix until you end up with maybe not the tightest possible piece of dance music you could have that's gonna have, you know, I hope, an impact when I play it on the floor.
Yeah, that's incredible. I don't know how he did it, but Darren Peacock managed to find all the episodes and follow you along.
I to dress up in costumes and do the dances. Man,
I mean, I saw clips on Instagram. It was super impressive, just amazing. It looks so fun, although it sounds intense.
Felt like a clown, but I was a clown that was getting paid.
Yeah, well,
so
right.
Paid well.
Yeah, there you go. Those are kind of the end of my questions, to be honest.
My experience with CCKT, like, you know, like, maybe still, like, who I am at a root, you know, like the root, like the most inside part of me, like the most true layer came out of CKET, you know. Wow. Like, I like to think that the good parts, you know, the stand-up guy parts, the good Samaritan parts,